Let's take stock of where global markets sit right now because the picture is genuinely complex. S&P futures are slightly negative this morning, down about 14 points to 75.31.5, which on a percentage basis is less than 0.2%, not alarm bell territory. But under that surface calm, there are several significant stresses worth tracking.
The yen at 163 per dollar is the number I keep coming back to. The last time the yen was this weak against the dollar was 1986. Japan's central bank has been in an extraordinarily difficult position, trying to normalize monetary policy after decades of near-zero rates, while managing the fact that a rising yen would hurt Japanese exporters significantly. But a weak yen makes imported energy more expensive, which feeds Japanese inflation, which creates pressure to raise rates, which could destabilize the carry trade, investors who borrowed in yen at near zero rates to invest in higher yielding assets globally. If the yen carry trade unwinds, the shock propagates far beyond Japan.
China's $9 billion market intervention producing a stock surge is a reminder that Beijing has both the tools and the willingness to support asset prices when they threaten to create feedback loops that undermine confidence. The Q2 GDP miss that preceded Premier Li Qiang's infrastructure push tells us the underlying economy is underperforming relative to targets. The six major national network construction initiatives, roads, rail, energy, water, digital, and transportation, is the classic Chinese playbook: stimulate through capital investment when consumption and export-driven growth underperform.
The Bitcoin surge on Clarity Act progress is the crypto story of the week. The White House clearing a key ethics hurdle for the bill removed what negotiators described as the final major obstacle to passage. The Clarity Act, for listeners unfamiliar, is legislation that would create a clear regulatory framework distinguishing which digital assets are commodities and which are securities, a distinction that has profound implications for how they can be traded, what disclosure requirements apply, and which regulatory agencies have jurisdiction. Clarity on that question removes one of the primary sources of regulatory uncertainty that has suppressed institutional crypto adoption.
The Morgan Stanley call on software stocks is worth examining because it goes against the recent consensus direction. Cutting Adobe and Workday to underweight while naming Microsoft and CrowdStrike as top picks in the AI era is a genuine contrarian stance on Adobe in particular, the company that built the dominant creative suite and has been integrating AI aggressively into its products. Morgan Stanley's argument, as I read it, is that AI tools are creating competition from directions Adobe didn't anticipate, exactly the kind of dynamic where the incumbent's business model faces structural pressure rather than just cyclical softness.
Let me bring in the curriculum corner here, because the Morgan Stanley call on software stocks actually invites a question about market dominance that has a precise legal meaning. When we talk about companies like Adobe or Microsoft potentially facing antitrust scrutiny as they extend their dominance into AI-era software, it's worth being clear about what monopoly actually means legally, because it's often misused in casual conversation.
The Sherman Antitrust Act, passed in 1890, and still the bedrock of American antitrust law, makes it illegal to monopolize or attempt to monopolize any part of trade or commerce. But here's what most people get wrong. Having a very large market share is not itself illegal. Courts have consistently held that being a monopolist, meaning having the power to control prices or exclude competition, doesn't violate the law on its own. What matters is how you got there and what you do with that power. If you built a dominant position through superior products and legitimate competition, that's not a Sherman Act violation. What triggers liability is using monopoly power to maintain or extend dominance through anti-competitive conduct, predatory pricing, exclusionary contracts, or bundling products in ways designed to foreclose competition rather than benefit consumers. The classic analogy is a corner store that becomes the only store in town because it had better prices and service. That's fine. But if that store then signs exclusive contracts with every food supplier to prevent a competitor from opening, that's where antitrust law gets interested.
And the modern tech context is complex because market share in software can be measured multiple ways: by users, by revenue, by enterprise penetration, by API calls. A company can have 90% of one market definition and 20% of another, and which definition you use determines whether the antitrust analysis even begins.
The Treasury's flagging of $99 million in payments to deceased recipients is a story that plays politically in multiple directions. The new verification system screened over 885 million federal payments worth nearly $2.7 trillion and caught more than 4,900 payments linked to deceased individuals before they went out. $99 million is real money and a real improvement in payment integrity. But it's also worth noting that 4,900 payments out of 885 million is a very small percentage, less than 0.06%. The system was already catching most errors. The question is whether the administration's communication about this is proportionate to the actual scale of the improvement.
Emirates rejecting 10 Boeing 777-9s and calling them fit for baked bean cans is a devastating quality control story for Boeing. Emirates is not a fringe customer. It's one of the world's largest and most operationally demanding airlines. When its leadership publicly uses that kind of language about new aircraft, it signals a breakdown in the relationship between Boeing and its most important customers that goes beyond technical snags.
Google quadrupling its Miami office space, with founders buying homes in the area, is part of a larger story about the geographic diversification of tech industry concentration away from San Francisco. Miami's real estate and tax environment, combined with its role as a gateway to Latin American markets, makes it an attractive secondary hub. When Google's founders are buying homes there, that's a meaningful commitment signal.